Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, freedom of inquiry, rationalism, scepticism, scientific method and liberal democracy. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And our guest this week is Josie Long. My name is Padraig Reedy, and I will now hand over to Neil Denny to introduce Josie.
Thanks, Padraig. Josie basically rounded off 2008 in our very last show, the last couple of minutes of that, and now she's beginning 2009 for us. So, but we have, there has been a gap in between. We have all been away and celebrated Christmas and the New Year and that. So in 1999, Josie Long won the BBC New Comedy Award at the age of 17, making her too young for the champagne that came as part of the prize. She then took a break and went to Oxford University to study English and English literature. And then she was named the Best Newcomer in the Chortle Awards of 2005 and became Best Breakthrough Act in the following year. In 2006, she also scooped Best Newcomer in the If.comedy Awards, which used to be the Perrier's, for her solo Edinburgh debut, Kindness and Exuberance. Her next show, Trying Is Good, is now available on DVD. Josie is currently touring All the Planet's Wonders, which is about, it says here, the magic of learning and making sense of the world. It's all about the little and big things in life. It covers the stars, wildlife, animals and museums, and being inspired by books she has read and people she has met along the way. Josie, thanks for coming on Little Atoms again.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to try and be more coherent than the last time I spoke to you.
Okay, well, luckily that was only a couple of minutes, so you've got a bit longer to be coherent tonight. So before we get into comedy and everything, tell us what you've been doing today.
Today I took my first module of my A-level maths exam, so it's technically the AS, and it was Pure Core Maths 1, and it was an hour and a half long, and it was awesome. It was the best exam. Well, it was all right in that I really... It's so fun to go to a school as an adult and take an exam because you look at everyone else and go, you're kids, I'm going to be better than you. You're kids, you don't know nothing. And it was kind of cool because a lot of the time with my GCSEs and my A-levels especially, and with my finals, I was so terrified it's kind of overruled everything else. Because at Oxford, especially for my course, it's really exam-based over about a week, so it's just terrifying. And but A-levels and GCSE, there were always bits that I hadn't bothered doing or that I hadn't revised or that, you know, I just thought I could be cavalier about. Whereas with this, I had studied everything on that syllabus and I had been over it and I knew it and I liked it and I understood it. So I got there and I was like, whoa, this question's easy. But that having been said, there were two questions which I didn't finish due to bad time planning and I'm furious.
So why have you done it?
I've done it because it's about three reasons. First reason is I started having nightmares that I was doing maths A-level and I hadn't done any of the work. And so I kind of thought, oh, well, maybe I should do maths A-level and I'll stop having nightmares, which is not a decision that I would make. I would never make that decision again. Like, it's not like I'd go, oh, my teeth keep falling out in dreams. I'll stick them. Well, I suppose I do brush my teeth.
You can have all your teeth pulled out.
But, yeah, exactly. You don't normally go, a dream told me to do this. Otherwise, you'd turn up to work naked or you would... I don't know. Sometimes I have really boring dreams. So there was that. And then also, it's just been part of trying to broaden myself out a bit because I've always loved literature and I always like saw myself when I was a teenager, especially as being really like arty and all the things that meant. And it was a very kind of romantic idea of what you should be as a human being. And so then I kind of realised a couple of years ago that, you know, that wasn't very diverse and there were a lot of things that I kind of wasn't exploring. Also, it's really fun. Like, I love the Sudoku and the Kokoro, right? But they are ultimately very frustrating. You start a Sudoku and you're like, oh, this is taxing, and then you do it and you're like, what? Nothing. You know, but with this, you start differentiation and at the end, like, I suddenly realised all of the data I could collect from the real world and mess around with and then create kind of differentiation experiments with it and kind of work out the rates of change for things in my own life. And I was so excited about that. I was just like, I can predict the future and understand the past and all these things, which I'm sure is like anyone who's normally done maths is like, yeah, I thought that on my first day and I realised it was stupid, but I don't care. I'm having a good time. So that's why I'm doing it.
So are you going to do something else? Are you going to, do you think, if this works out?
Well, this is going to be 2 years, and it's a bit more of a commitment than I thought it was.
Yeah,
like,
I
meant to start it a year ago, and then I was just like, oh, God, there's so much work, so I didn't do it. It sort of doesn't leave time for much other reading or hobbies because it's about 8 hours a week that you've got to put in, really, or maybe a bit less. But because I'm teaching myself pretty much, I sort of need to put in a good few hours a week. So I'm digesting this. And then, to be honest, after that, hang on, I'm 26. I just started it. I'll be finished next year. I really want to do an MA in American Literature, so I might try and hopefully I will have struck some sort of seam of finances that hasn't yet appeared to me, and then I can do an MA.
Sounds great. Well, let's get into talking about comedy then. I was listening to you used to do the Robbins podcast, the show and tell things, and there was a couple at the end where you sort of bunked off from, and
I was in Australia. I wanted to do it. He said I could do it down the phone, and then he didn't call me. He just got someone else to replace me.
The Barry Cryer one, Danielle Ward stands in for. There's a really great discussion on there, basically, where they talk about how you how there's this crazy idea that you can learn stand up comedy from a book or from going and doing comedy workshops.
Yeah.
And I thought we should probably talk about how you got into this whole comedy thing.
Well, I did go to workshops. I was 14. But the thing is, what they were like was there was a guy who ran them who was a brilliant inspiration and quite a mentor to me. And it's only the last couple of years that I've realised just how much weed he smokes, because I had no idea. Am I allowed to say that? I can't say that.
It's resonance.
Talking
go
about
crazy.
Another human being.
Yeah.
Apparently not. No, I'm just saying that's what he does. I'm not saying that I think it's a good thing. If anything, I think it's very destructive.
Don't do
for
it,
one's
kids.
Memory, and also makes you a bit paranoid that there will be robbers coming into your house when your boyfriend's not there. Let me tell you that for free. that is why when I was 17, I behaved badly. No, here we go. There was this guy who ran them, and basically all he would say was, you need to work on finding your voice, and you need to really, really develop everything. And then what would happen is, there'd be about five or six people. It'd be me, a few empty nester people who was kind of like women in their 50s who were a bit like lonely. And then there'd be a couple of very
weird...
They
would turn up for basket weaving or whatever, but you know,
exactly.
That was full.
And then there was some comedy. They're like, I can talk. No one tells me to shut up. So that's good. And there was very weird guys in their 20s who wrote kind of one-liners. And there's a couple of people that I met that I'm still friends with that are brilliant. And we just would present material and, like, it was a lovely atmosphere to try stuff out because... It wasn't the pressure of a gig. And it wasn't like other stand-up courses, which are literally week one, satire, week two, which is is rubbish. But this one was just this one man saying, oh, that's got potential, you should find your persona. And that's all he would say. So it was good. It's so funny as well, because there are actually some good books about stand-up out there. And there are some good books in quite an instructional way about stand-up out there. There's one called, this is going to sound stupid, but there's one called Zen and the Art of Stand-Up Comedy. And it's by, I can't remember. And I read it when I was at university. So when I was at university, I didn't go home in the holidays. I just stayed up in Oxford and I would go into the Radcliffe Camera and research about comedy just for fun. So like read about like 1950s Jewish comedians and stuff like that. And there's this book. Am I talking too much? I probably am.
No, you're the guest. You're about to talk too
much. But anyway, there's this book called Zen and the Art of Stand-Up Comedy. And one of the basic like thrusts of the book was, you are trying to be a stand-up comic. You're not trying to do comedy. And I really feel like that's something you can think about and really learn and stuff and reinforce. Like, you're not just picking up and putting down jokes. If you've really committed to it as a vocation, it's totally everything. Sort of, you know, you're thinking about it as... your art that you, God, that's really pretentious, but your thing that you love that you're bringing the rest of your life to.
Yeah. That's really interesting, because that sort of goes against the thing that they were talking about the courses and the books, is that this idea that you are funny, you can't learn, you know, it's not something that you can learn, it's like you have to have, you know, but obviously there are comedians that have a funny persona, and there are comedians that are just, you know, have funny material, which is...
Yeah, and there are comedians that buy material.
Yeah,
and,
of course,
you know,
writers.
But I think it's like everything, like... You don't have to be the greatest, funniest person in the world to be really good. You just have to, I think, you have to be intensely committed to it, and you have to be really in love with it, and you have to be sort of, you have to be willing to do it. And I think if you keep that up in the long term, that's almost enough. But I also think that you can develop your own style, and that's really important. So you can, in a way, learn how to be the funniest you can be. And it's always a process of fine-tuning how to convey why you think something's funny to the crowd and stuff.
The style, I suppose, that you've developed is, I suppose, encapsulated in the name of the last DVD, is trying is good. It doesn't, you know, a general kind of enthusiasm for things. And is that an extension of your personality, or is it a conscious thing that you think, this is somewhere I can go?
Yeah, that's what it is. I just thought it's a good angle. It's maybe no money. That's exactly an extension of my attitude to life. Mm. Like, I think both of the first two shows that I wrote, and this show, like every show I've written has been about what I'd really felt was important and the things that I'd learnt over the sort of time of writing it. And I sort of wanted to really convey how I think you should live your life as part of. But then, do you know what? I think most stand-up, unless you're buying it and you really don't care, unless you see yourself as someone who tells jokes, you can't help... It's like all things you make. You can't help but show people who you are, and you can't help but show people what you're interested in, because you're taking the time to make that thing, you know? And so, yes, that's really obvious, isn't it? Yeah, it's definitely a life philosophy. I think it's good.
But it's not... I mean, it's... This is, it's a fantastic attitude to have towards it, because a lot of people are not that devoted to being stand-up comics. A lot of stand-up comics see it as, a stepping stone onto the real important stuff, family fortunes
that
or whatever,
But I know people that are like that, and it really makes me gutted I think I'm lucky, because when I was 17 and I won this thing, and it was still a pretty small fry thing, but that year was about the only year that they televised it on BBC One for like this ridiculous reason. And so what happened was I got this really little taste of like this weird fame that I didn't really understand. Like, because now if I'd have been 17, I could have been on bloody The In-Betweeners. I could have been massively successful. No, I didn't. But like, basically, like, I had this taste of sort of what it was like to have people recognise you in this weird way, and it really spun my head out a bit, and it made me realise, oh no, I'm not interested. What I love is the stand-up. And actually, what happens to these, I don't know all the time, but a lot of the time stand-ups go off and look for other things, and then they come back to stand-up and go, oh yeah, I love this the most, because it's so immediate, you've got so much control, and it's so brilliant, and when it works, it's just marvellous. But then, that having been said, I really like the fact that I've got a DVD now, because I feel like it's so ephemeral, and it feels nice to have caught a bit of it and gone, that is what I was doing, and I'm proud of it, you know?
It's a great DVD. It's got very high production values. It's got lovely menus.
Thank you.
I mean, comedy's great and all that, but the menus are really good.
I'm very proud of the menus.
I'd recommend the DVD on the quality of its menus alone.
It was a girl called Georgina, and now this is annoying because she used to work for a big company, and now she's gone freelance, so she could do with a plug on the radio, but I can't remember her surname, but she was ever so good, and she really did exactly what I wanted to do, and I was really...
Doesn't it say on
it.
The back?
Oh, no, but yeah, but it wouldn't... Oh, hang on. No, it just says Grey Box Design, which is where she probably used to work. But... Yeah. Sorry.
Anyway, Georgina is very
she was
good.
Brilliant.
So a bit of hardcore Googling could probably sort that one out. But I mean, you say the kind of ephemeral nature, and it's nice to have something kind of down, recorded. Is there, how prey as a stand-up can you be to, particular circumstances, particular night, particular crowd? I mean, obviously you develop a show and it hangs together coherently, but how scary is it having to hoof it in some ways by the same token with a different crowd every night?
Well, it really depends, and like also stand-up to stand-up it depends, because some people, they just thrive on it and they love it and they deliberately leave loads of space and they muck around, and some people pretend that they're doing that and actually they're not at all. It's something that I want to develop better, because often when I'm touring a show, there'll be bits where I deliberately improvise and I try my hardest to connect with the crowds. Like when I was... Sorry, I keep nearly burping because I had this mocha with orange syrup in and I'm not used to it. It's something I try and do on tour shows, is like, especially my first tour show, I would ask people little questions, get people to hand in things and have games and stuff, because I really do like the fact that you can connect with a different set of people at every gig. And I like the fact that there's new variables every night that you can't anticipate, and even in the same venue it's so changeable and things like that. It is really a thrill. But at the same time, I really wish I could adapt my shows slightly more so that over the course of a tour they developed a bit, because I find they get refined, but... They don't move on as much as I'd like. But then I've only done two, so this one's going to be different. Yeah.
So that leading us neatly on to the show we're up now, which is, as I understand, what was the name?
All the Planet's Wonders.
It's called All of the Planet's Wonders, brackets, shown in detail, close brackets.
So what's that all about then?
It's about... It's the same sort of thing about broadening myself out. It's about, but it's also about how much I love the Enlightenment. Like, I wanted to write something that was talking about how much I love the sentiments of the Enlightenment, like the idea of becoming a polymath and about collecting and about sort of the importance of museums and about the idea that kind of you can categorise and understand the world and that that will shore you against, you know, kind of coming out and clarity and... And also, so it was sort of it's sort of about that and about wanting to be an 18th century gentleman. And and then it's about, like, starting to read more about astronomy again. And then it's also a radio show that I've just written. It's going to be on Radio 4 in February. And it's the radio show is different, though, because it's probably better because I wrote it over more time. So it's kind of, the first one's about astronomy and about... how difficult I always found it to see the stars. And people go, oh, look, can you see that? I'd be like, no. Can you see the plough? Yes. That's all I can see. And so it's that one. And about overcoming that. And we actually got the guy who wrote my book, Professor Stephen P. Maron, PhD, recipient of the NASA Medal for Exceptional Achievement. He came onto the show and did a little bit. And it was so exciting. Very exciting. And then we did one about the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford and museums and collecting. And in that, Dr. Gunther von Hagen is like this evil baddie with a zombie army and he's got a sword. Oh, no, Benjamin Stillingfleet, who the term blue stocking was coined after, who was this awesome Enlightenment gentleman. And he is the hero and he kills Dr. Gunther von Hagen with a sword at the end. It's brilliant. And then the third one is about animals and about facts and about... Because I sort of really love this idea that when you're a kid, you're desperate to learn facts. And sort of as an adult, you can just... become very complacent and read things that aren't really facts and just get on with not really doing anything in any depth. And so it's sort of a fight back against that and a sort of embracing of all the things left not to know. And then the fourth one is about botany, but it's mainly just lists of stupid plant names. Oh, and about Adventure Botanists, which is another big Enlightenment thing.
Which is what?
Adventure botanists? Oh, my word. In the 18th century, people going around the world in, like, the most intrepid ways to bring back plant cuttings. Just that was a job that you could have. So brilliant. Speaking of which, I went to the Darwin exhibition, and so much of it is just Charles Darwin's diaries, where he went, "We found a tortoise, I ate it." It's just like, "We ate the orangutans." And I found out that Charles Darwin, from this exhibition, he started a club at Cambridge University for people who wanted to eat strange animals.
And it's still that's still going, isn't it?
Oh, I understand, man. Yeah. I went to the wrong university. I love to eat strange animals. I had a goose stuffed with a chicken stuffed with a pheasant for Christmas. So was that. And also, he was the way he found out about kind of the fact that these animals haven't had predators was by tormenting them. So he'd be like, "You can pull its leg," and it didn't even care. So I did it over and over again.
But there was
on them. What's it called? Melvin Bragg thing.
In our time,
though, this very week, oh God, I'm sorry, really? This is really tedious. Tedious for the listeners, but they were basically talking about how he was doing these experiments on babies, on children.
What?
Where he was basically, they were just basically tormenting the babies, getting them to cry, and it was like, it was trying to understand how the babies cried. It was like, I spoke to Lady So-and-so about her child, and I got her to basically provoke her child into crying and told me what its eyes did when it cried.
He's such a prankster. I didn't really. Do you think of him as being so solemn, you know, or worthy? And then he's just this guy who threw a lizard into the sea over and over again.
But I also love what you said about the botanist, the great thing. I'm a big bird watcher, and I just really, it's great when you read in the sort of 19th century where people started, you know, started collating sort of various different species and stuff. It was all, you know, they would go out there and basically. Shoot them.
Yeah,
collectors totally. Would go out and find a new species. There's a bird. I've never seen that one
Bang.
Before. Bang! Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And take it back. And it's like terrible but brilliant.
It's going on the Natural History Museum and like this massive corpse parade. Well, there's one. It's so strange. But, you know, we're bigger than them and we win. They were clever. They have guns and they bloody fight back, but they don't, do they?
Let's go back. I want to get back to because Padraig's already sort of raised this. The idea about doing your shows to different audiences every night, and I want to sort of take that a little bit further because you have a your shows have a I couldn't really think of a polite way to say this. So sod it. Basically, what I've written down is your shows demand a certain amount of sort of patience from the audience, because it's like you have to take them along with you. You sort of build up to.
Yeah, I would like to think that they are funny though, and I'd like to think that they indeed. Do the work. And I also like to think.
But
that
it's not like it's not, you know, it's not bang bang bang. You know,
I've got like 3 one-liners in my new show, so you will be pretty chastised if you say. No, you're right. There's sometimes there'll be bits where I'm just talking, and I just want people to listen. And sometimes, totally.
Well, what I'm trying to get to, not very well, is that, you know, now obviously you know you're doing you've got your own hour long shows, you're doing theatres, and that people are coming to see you. Mm. But obviously, at one point, there was a time when you were doing this at. You know,
clubs,
jonglers on a Friday night
I didn't pass that test, so I never had to do it. I still have it at clubs sometimes. Like, I had a gig just before I did the Atheist show on the Sunday, and I also did a gig in Greenwich that day. And I sort of came on, and it's my friend's night, it's a really indie night, and I came on just a bit ramshack. I was like, who's looking forward to Christmas? I am. And I wasn't making jokes straight away, because I just thought, you know, it's my friend's gig, I've done it before, it's nice. And these guys were like, we hate you. And it was awful, and I proper heckled, and I had to be like, shut up and F off, or both, you know, and like, had to really go at them because they were so confrontational. And I'm glad that I don't do that sort of atmosphere. But I also feel like there's quite a great independent circuit of clubs, and I feel like it's self-renewing. Like, they're run by people who love it, and maybe the life expectancy for a club like that is only a year and a half. But London is so beautiful and such a wellspring of potential that after a year and a half, 3 more people will have moved to London, 3 years younger, who are desperate to do it, and they'll have the same sort of tastes and aspirations. So it's you don't have to do it as much.
And you've done that yourself. I mean, that's what I was sort of getting to,
club.
That you set up your own clubs.
I did.
Indeed. So.
My club, I love my club loads and loads, but it's sort of on hiatus for a moment. I think it sort of springs from the trying thing. Like, it's so easy to... with stand-up, to do your own thing. Like, you just don't have to accept the status quo. And that's what I really hate about, you know, you see, when you meet young comics and they say, pardon me, oh, I think gong shows are a good way to develop as a comedian. You're like, no, they're not. They're horrible. Like, the good way to develop as a comedian is to run your own night and do an hour at that night over the course of the night, introducing people, you know, setting the night up. That's a good way to develop the most stage time and the most writing and the most kind of finding your voice you can do. Is going to harden you much more than 4 minutes before you get gonged off. But that having been said, like, I did do loads of nights where I died and died and died, and where people hated me, and I've had really terrifying hatred and, like...
So what's that? I mean, tell us about that. What's that like? You know, if you're doing something where you know, they're just completely hostile.
It's fine. Like, it's fine. You just get... Like, you just don't care. Like, it's the same with, like... press criticism, after a while, you don't care. Everything that happens to you, you go, right, that's happened now. Either I love this or I don't. And I've had periods, like, I had this period where some people were being really insane and, like, half stalking me on the internet and being really mentally ill. And they were, like, such losers and so horrible. And it really, for a while, just crushed me. And, like, when I did crush me is the wrong word, but I felt like it changed my attitude to it. I was sort of scared of going on stage and I felt weird. And then after a while, I just thought, like, no, I don't care. I love this. And it's fine. And I sort of feel like nothing. It's such a good thing. There's not enough bad things. I talked so much. I'm so sorry. And I'm not answering the questions very well either.
You answered that perfectly. Yes. How terrible is it when you're confronting a stag party at a terrible
but
club,
do you know,
basically?
Here's how it goes. Live hecklers, sometimes they win and you're really gutted, or sometimes it's just so unfair and they won't listen to you and they outnumber you and they're big, and then, like, sometimes if there's a big loads of, like, on this Christmas gig, there's big loads of hard men, and, like, I'm thinking, you're deliberately intimidating me, you know. But actually, heckling in the flesh is really quite great fun sometimes, and when you win, it's such a great feeling because you feel like, yeah, well, I win because I'm clever and funny and you're a div, and it's brilliant, you know. Whereas something like criticism in print, especially from journalists you respect, or criticism, especially when it's unfair or inaccurate, or criticism on the internet, which you just feel like, these are anonymous people and they don't know what they're doing. You know, that can be harder sometimes because you feel like there's no recourse and you can't go, yeah, well, you're an idiot. You just have to go, well, I'll... But your reward is your happy life and your artistic endeavours, and their reward is bad eyesight from staring at computer screens. So...
perfect sentiment to end on, I think.
God, did that seem a bit vitriolic about this?
But yeah, but you know, sod on. That's a good point. We managed to get through the entire interview without mentioning the word whimsical as well, which I'm quite pleased about.
It's very weird how people, like, they put you in a box. Like, I feel like I'm 26, I've hardly started. Like, most people don't start making their good stuff till they're 35 or whatever. Like, why would I know what I was? Anyway.
Josie, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Sorry for talking so much. I'm